This is Bad Apples, Episode 9, Season 4. In this episode, I'm going to talk about compiling software. And I know that I've talked about compiling software in, I think, an episode back in Season 2. But I've come up with some tips, I think, that will help people who might not have installed that compiled that much figure out how to compile more efficiently with fewer errors, things like that. And hopefully just kind of remove the barrier of compiling software from source code. So let's get started, shall we? So lately, a couple of different people have been asking me questions about compiling from source code. Not a whole lot of people, but a couple of people with a couple of questions that happily I was able to answer. And it got me thinking about compiling, and I kind of then thought about a blog post that I had read that Dan Washko had written. And this was kind of tackling one of those fairly frequent topics of speculation within the Linux community about whether Linux needs a unified packaging format. And I won't even go into that question because I think every 3 or 4 months we go into that question on Linux Cranks. So tune in to Linux Cranks in about 2 months and we'll probably talk about it again. But until then, I will let you know what Dan Washko's blog posting said. And he said that Linux does not need a unified packaging format because Linux has source code. So why would you need a packaging format to rule them all when anyone can just grab the source code, compile it, and run it? Now, I found this extremely, extremely insightful, and it kind of cuts through the whole debate over whether we need a universal packaging format or which packaging format is best, .deb versus .rpm, .whatever else there is. And it also it pushes aside the presumption that we need a packaging format at all. And he is right. As long as you're using free software, you can grab the source code and compile it and start running it right away. Now, the problem there is that compiling software can be a little bit daunting to someone who hasn't compiled from source code before, or that someone who has done it here and there as needed, and when it gets down to, you know, I need this program and it's not packaged yet, I must compile it. Sometimes it's a more complex compile than maybe you're used to. So what this episode is going to hope to do is help eliminate some of that initial fear if you've never compiled or if you've only compiled a couple of times. It's going to hopefully answer some questions and help you troubleshoot through little problems that might arise while compiling. And it will discuss a little bit about when you should compile versus when maybe you should not compile. And I'm sure there'll be some more stuff in there, but that's what we're going to try to cover first and foremost. I should mention, of course, standard disclaimer, I'm not a programmer. I'm not even a packager yet. So I'm really just a Linux user who happens to have compiled a couple of times. So, you know, I've compiled here and there, and hopefully I've got some tips that you will find interesting and helpful. So, an introduction to compiling. /configure, make, and then as root, make install. That's it. That's how you compile software from source code. Now, realistically, when you issue those three commands, you're going to encounter three different possible scenarios. First scenario is that compiling works. You issue the commands, it makes a lot of text scroll on your screen, and next thing you know, you're running the program. That easy. Second scenario, compiling doesn't work because of something that is lacking on your system. That's the one that you can usually fix. That's the one that we'll concentrate a lot on in this episode. And then there's the third scenario, which is compiling doesn't work, but it's not because of something you don't have, it's because of something in the code, something that maybe the programmer's gotten wrong, or maybe it's just a simple matter of wasn't written for your brand of Unix. And while you could go in and make the changes if you were a programmer, some things are just going to be so specific that it's just not going to work the way that you want it to work on your system. So, in order to understand why things don't compile, it could be helpful to understand why things do compile. And this is pretty quick, but let's just go through the three steps and talk about what they do. .configure, which you do from within the source code directory, and I'll go through like the whole, I'll do the whole workflow of going out, finding source code, untarring it, compiling it, stuff like that. But for now, so you do the .configure, and what that does is check your system to make sure that it's got the correct compiler installed and the correct build utilities and things like that. If you don't have those things installed, you're going to get an error. If you do have those things installed and all the options are set that need to be set and stuff like that, then it's going to succeed, and it usually doesn't make a big fanfare or anything. It just doesn't give you any errors, and you're ready to do the next step, which is make. So make is going to compile the code. This is actually where you're building the application. Straight from the make man page, the purpose of the make utility is to determine automatically which pieces of a large program need to be recompiled and issue the commands to recompile them. That's what make does. If this step succeeds, you've compiled the source code. It's done, basically. All you have to do now is install it. And of course, as root, whether that's sudo make install or su space dash c space single quote make space install end single quote, that's what you issue to get the executable binaries that you've just compiled to where they need to go, and all the different bits and pieces that are needed for the application, like man pages or whatever, are copied to wherever they need to be in your system. And of course, because a lot of them are going to system directories like /usr or /bin, then you obviously, that's why you need to do it as root. And that is what happens when you compile something and it works. Those three easy steps, and that's what's happening on a well-tuned and well-written application, well-tuned system, that's what happens. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about where we're getting all this stuff from. I mean, what do I do when I go out and say, okay, today I feel like compiling? Well, let's take an ideal world where nothing ever goes wrong, right? So you're out on the internet, and you find an application that looks pretty cool, but it hasn't been packaged as an RPM or a .dev or whatever you need yet. The source code is available, though, so you download it, right? And you download it, and maybe you download it to a folder that you've got called Downloads. Or maybe you download it straight to /tmp. Or maybe you're like me, and you do /home/klaatu/code and save it into there. That's what I usually do, because I like to keep all the source code that I've compiled, and I know it's not necessary. I kind of like to, just, I don't know why. So that's where I dump it. I dump it in my home directory in a directory called code. So you would navigate to whatever directory you've saved the source code in. So I'm going to go to /home/klaatu/code, and then I'm going to untar the source code. And again, the tar command, you just do tar-x for extract, z for ungzip, and then f for the file, and then you tell it what file you want to unarchive. So in our case, maybe it would be foobar.tar.gz. So we do tar-xzf, foobar.tar.gz, and that unarchives it, creates a folder called foobar-0.5. That would be the version of foobar that we downloaded. And as I kind of hinted toward earlier, when you are going out and finding source code, they often have unstable versions, and then they have stable releases of just the source code even. You may want to go with the stable release. You may want to go with the bleeding edge. Just be aware, obviously, that the bleeding edge, while it will probably have some of the newer features that they're talking about, it's still under development, so you have to be really mindful of the fact that it might be more prone to crashing, or there might be certain things that are only partially implemented in it, whatever. So, typically speaking, I go with the stable releases, and they usually make differentiate between the two on their website, on their project site. So now we've got this foobar-0.5 directory, right? So we cd into it. So cd foobar-0.5. And you're going to see lots of different files. These are the source code files, things that you and I may never understand what to do with. Well, we know what to do with them, but we may not understand how they actually work. But, you'll see things like authors, copying, install, readme, to-do, just all these weird little text files, usually all in capital letters. And then there's other ones like config.h, configure, configure.ac, makefile, foobar, maybe a foobar.pro, changelog, config.status, icons, just all kinds of random things. First off, for me, always, is if you see a README file, read that document. if you don't see your README, a lot of times you'll want to read the install document, which again, it's all in capitals usually, and it's just a text document, so you can just do a less install or less README, whichever one is there, and you will get to read that file. Since we're operating in a perfect world, as I've said, where nothing ever goes wrong and compiling is always easy, we're going to imagine that this README file is really, really well written. Of course, you're not going to be that lucky all the time, but we're going to assume that this one is. So we'll we do a less on it, and it says the installation procedure is simple. You do a .configure, you do a make, and then as root, make install. This procedure will end installing the following couple of files, /bin/foobar/share/pixmaps/foobar.png, and then /share/application/foobar.desktop, for instance. And there might be some mentions of, like, prefixes, things like that. And this is where you get into kind of advanced compiling, I guess, or at least intermediate. For instance, maybe on the .configure option, it might have given us in brackets the option to do a --prefix=usr/local, for instance. That's an optional thing that we can do. We can define the prefix. Now, if we don't define the prefix, it's going to do whatever it knows, you know, it's set to do. The point is that that's a fairly easy install, because all you have to do is the .configure. You don't have to worry about any options or any fancy prefixes or anything like that. You just do .configure, make, and then as root, make install. So we do that. We'll just do the .configure, the make, and then the make install, and sure enough, it all works, meaning we have all the correct compilers, and that it was able to compile and build, and that it was able to install everything in the different directories that it wanted to install stuff into. Sure enough, we could check later, and in /user/local/bin, we'll find a foobar executable. That's the little application that we should be able to run to launch the application. And there'll be an icon file in the /user/local/share/pixmaps, and a symlink called foobar.desktop, which is for quick launching, in the /user/local/share/applications directory, which is something that I know KDE uses a lot. GNOME used to, but I don't know if they do anymore. Point is that that's it. You've sought out some source code, you found it, you downloaded it, you untarred it, you issued the three magic commands, and now it's installed. How do you run it? Well, again, since this is an ideal, perfect world and everything's easy, it'll be in your little menu, your application menu. It automatically gets installed in there. Well, that's cool. If it is not for some reason, then you just need to launch it from a terminal, which, again, it's already told us in the README file that it is located in some /bin file called foobar, so you can just do foobar, as long as you have that directory in your path, which you probably do. Okay, so that was the quick and easy way to go out and compile something. Now, if you're like me, the first application you'll find out there on the World Wide Web with source code available will be some really complex, obscure application, and you're going to try to compile it, and you're going to get nothing but compile errors. So now we're going to do some failed attempts and solve these failed attempts. It's going to be very exciting, so just hold on to your hat. But first, I should take a break and get another cup of coffee and maybe play a promo or something like that. So I will be right back. Time for a coffee break. Go get yourself a cup of coffee and listen to this promo, and we'll be right back.
Come celebrate 40 years of Unix at the Ohio Linux Fest from September 25th through the 27th. If you use GNU Linux, BSD, OpenSolaris, or any Unix or Unix-like system, you belong at Ohio Linux Fest. Register free today at ohiolinux.org.
So, going through each command that might fail step by step. Of course, the first step is still .configure. As we've said, when it works, you've got the correct compilers installed and all that other good stuff. When it doesn't work, quite possibly one of the reasons it might not work is because you don't have the correct compiler installed on your system. Now, this is fairly common on a system, especially if you installed from, like, a live CD or something. I mean, a lot of the live CDs, in order to keep their distribution down to the size of fitting onto a CD, they need to leave out big packages like GCC, which not everyone is going to use all the time. So if you invoke .configure and you get errors about no C compiler found, something like that, then all you need to do is make sure that you've got GCC installed. Sometimes you might get some kind of error it might pass the C compiler test, but fail the C++ compiler test. So the point is, you're going to need the correct compiler installed. And a couple of different ways you can do that. There are searches that you can perform, like, you know, yum search GCC, or apt cache search GCC, or aptitude, and then search for GCC, or URPMI, --fuzzy, --test, --GCC, and so on, just depending on what distribution you've got. Now, if you're running something like Slackware or Gentoo, you've already got GCC installed, so you won't have to go through this at all. But otherwise, you might have to do this. There are a couple of different groupings of packages that you can also install. I guess they're sort of like meta packages or something. I know in Fedora it would be group install developer tools. In Ubuntu it's something like apt-get install build essentials or something like that. So those two will get, you know, GCC. They'll get, I don't know what else they get, probably like CMake or QMake, lots of different applications that you might find that you need during the building process. So that's not a bad idea. If you know you're going to be building from source, you might as well grab the whole package, the whole bundle. So do that, and in theory, after you've installed GCC, you should be able to do a /configure, and it should work. This is generally true until, like I say, maybe you've installed GCC, but then you go to compile a program written in C++, at which point you're going to discover that you get an error, because default GCC doesn't do C++. So how would you know that something was written in C++, for instance? It's not like it gives you a little message that says, oh, sorry, you're trying to compile C++, but GCC doesn't do that. You need G++. It doesn't tell you that. It just says there's an error. The first, I guess, really easy sort of why didn't I think of that method would be look at the project's website. It's weird because a lot of times I guess we've heard about a program and we go to download it and we just grab it off of, you know, we Google for it and then it takes us to SourceForge straight to the download page. We download it and we start. And it's just like, well, you don't know nothing about this application at this point. You've got the code, you've heard about it, you've heard it's good, but you don't know what it's built with. So if you look at the project's website or at least their main SourceForge page where it gives information on the project, or something like that, you know, something online, it'll probably tell you what it's been written in. It'll say, QTractor is a C++ Qt-based multi-track audio program. That would tell you right there that it was built with C++ with the Qt GUI toolkit. So you've got all the information you need, really, in order to build it. You know right away that some of your dependencies are going to be something to compile C++ and the Qt toolkit. Good to know. The second way is one after you unzip it or whatever you need to do with the source code is to just have a quick look around the source code folder, that directory. Pretty quickly you'll see things like .cpp. You know, that would be C++. And this is where the geek level gets in. I mean, if you don't know that .cpp indicates that it is a C++ application, then you wouldn't know that. If you see a .rb, you can bet it's going to be a Ruby project, that you're going to need some kind of Ruby, maybe Ruby Qt or just Ruby, who knows. .py would be Python. .c is probably a C program. You know, these little indications that, yeah, not everyone's going to know, but it would help if you you develop sort of a sense for what different extensions are on different programming languages. And it's not something that every user needs to know, but if you're going to be compiling a lot, it's something that you might just want to start picking up on. You don't have to go read a book on the subject, just kind of take note of it when you see it. And then the third one is the error message itself. And this is a little bit, it's like obvious, and yet it's not obvious. So, like, when you're doing a /configure, you know, you get all this output. It tells you, well, I'm checking for GCC, and then it says ...GCC, and it gives you that GCC once it establishes that, yes, GCC is there. And it says, checking for C compiler default output file name, ...A.out. Checking whether the C compiler works, ...Yes. Checking whether we are cross-compiling, ...No. You know, it just goes through all these little steps that are steps of the .configure process. And then finally, in this case, since we're imagining that it failed once it was trying to find the G++, it'll say, checking for G++. And then it will probably stop spitting out things, and it will show you that, rather, because it failed, then you look at the last thing it was doing, and that last thing is probably what it failed on, you know? So in this case, it was a G++ check, and it couldn't find G++, so it stopped at the /configure, because it required the G++. Now, granted, G++ is not the same as C++, And again, the error message, it could be a lot more user-friendly if it was to say, sorry, .configure has failed because you need to install a program called G++ in order to compile C++ code. That would be very user-friendly. It'd be really nice. At the same time, it doesn't take, you know, a programmer to figure out that G++ and C++ are probably related in some way. And sure enough, it is. Now you have to go find G++, right? This is sometimes kind of difficult in itself, and I'll tell you why. Because if you go to a Fedora box and you sit down and you do a yum search G++, you will get a couple of different results. None of them are what we need. We get an ARM-GP2X-Linux-GCC-C++. That's the cross-compiling GNU G++, but it's for ARM only. Then there's an AVR, blah, 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 and that's cross-compiling targeted at something called AVR. Don't know what that is. I guess it's a chip. And then there's procbench.i386, and that's a multi-platform information tool and CPU benchmark for x86 procs. That doesn't help us a bit. And yet we did search for the very thing that we, you know, that it seemed to be failing on, which is G++. Well, luckily we've already established that G++ and C++ are very closely related, they're intertwined. So let's do a yum search C++. Now this would give you a billion results. That's like 400 results or something. But if you scan through the results, or you do some creative grepping around, you're going to narrow it down. And eventually you will find, by the description, one that says gcc-c++.i, 586, I think is what it is now, on the default Fedora. And that says in the description, C++ support for GCC. Bingo, that's what we need. And so that then you would say yum install, the exact name of it, gcc-c++, and hit return, and it will install that package. And then .configure will run without failure, at least in theory. Of course, there are other errors that you could receive during the .configure process. Maybe you don't have the correct toolkit installed. Like I said, let's just use QTractor for an example for a moment. Let's say that we're on a GNOME system for some reason, and we're trying to install QTractor, and we've just gotten through the G++ error, and now we're doing it again. It gets through G++, says checking whether G++ accepts -G, yes, checking how to run the C++ preprocessor, gives it a flag, it goes through all these things, and then it says checking for Qt library version greater than or equal to 4.1. No, Qt 4.1 or greater is required. And then it returns you to a bash prompt. That's one of the more friendly errors I've ever seen in a compiling process, actually. It pretty clearly says, no, I can't proceed from here, because the Qt 4.1, Qt 4.1 is, or greater, is required. That tells you exactly what you need. You need Qt 4.1 or greater. So then, of course, you'd go back to your repository, look around for all the Qt libraries, or you do like a group install of KDE, because obviously that would bring along the all the Qt stuff. Or, you know, in a pinch, you can go to qtsoftware.com, that's qtsoftware.com, and download it for yourself and install Qt manually. So just lots of different ways to get this toolkit, but like I say, the most common way to do it is just to get do a group install of just all the KDE stuff, and that brings Qt along with it. Now, let's say for some reason you didn't know what Qt 4.1 was. There's that wonderful fallback, and so you go to Google, and you can just Google something like, you know, Qt toolkit or Qt 4.1, something like that, and, you know, you'll figure it out pretty quickly from there. So these, so far, in my perhaps limited experience, seem to be the most common errors during .configure. But there might be others, but, I mean, you're going to find that either, you know, looking at their website, or doing an internet search, or reading their documentation is going to kind of, and especially reading the error messages, are going to guide you towards some kind of reasonable solution. I don't think it always says, like, configure has finished, now type make. Sometimes it just completely quietly finishes, it just stops going, and the absence of a true error message is your sign that it has succeeded. And that, from what I understand, is kind of traditional in the whole Unix and Linux world, that no news is good news. Returning zero means success, returning one means failure. So if you hear something bad, it's failed. If you don't hear anything at all, it's succeeded. Either way, it'll finish, you'll know it succeeded, you will type make. again, when make works, the code has been compiled. When it doesn't work, chances are you don't have dependencies on your system that the program needs to compile correctly. The big deal about apt and yum and all that other stuff is that they resolve dependencies for you, meaning that if you want to install FooBar and FooBar needs libusb to run, then apt or yum will first install libusb, as if you wouldn't have that on your system already, and then it would install FooBar. That's really cool. That's really nice. But compiling from source code doesn't bring along this luxury. You have to make sure that you've got, you know, manually, you have to make sure that you've got libusb installed before you try to install FooBar. So, running make on this application FooBar, let's say that we run make and we'll see a whole bunch of output on this. It'll give you flags, it'll give you configs, it'll list the different files that it's looking at, and then at some point you'll start to see error. For instance, GUI.h 49 error expected equal comma comma semicolon asm or attribute before token. Just cryptic things like that that you and I have no clue is what they mean. The point is that you're going to get some errors, and then finally it's just going to cop out. So that's a lot of errors, and obviously make didn't work in this case. The way to look at these errors is to find out where they start. In this case, let's just say it started out with cc space dash c draw dot c dash I dot slash sdl config dash dash c flags dash w dash ggdb. Okay, sure, that's the first line. And then the second line would be slash bin slash sh colon sdl dash config colon command not found. And then on the very next line, I start seeing errors. Okay. So the line right before the errors started to appear is slash bin slash sh sdl dash config command not found. Okay, well, we already know what to do, right? We have to find out what this sdl dash config is, because that's when it hit that, it started outputting errors for us. So maybe we'll start with a repository search. So we'll do a yum search sdl dash config. Or a Google search for sdl-config. If we don't have any kind of package manager or a package manager that we don't know how to use or something, look for sdl-config, find out what this is. And it will check for that, and unfortunately, no matches are found. Okay, no problem, we have Google. So now do a Google search for sdl-config. And what you'll find out from a Google search is that sdl-config is part of a package called, well, it's really just called SDL. So now we're going to go back to our repository. We're going to do a yum search SDL. Or we could even do a yum list SDL. And that'll list all the packages with SDL in it. So, sure enough, if you do a yum list SDL, it gives you all the different packages that you have installed and that you don't have installed. And in my case, what happened was that I already had SDL installed, which was kind of weird, you know, because I thought, well, wait a minute, I thought SDL config is supposed to be a part of SDL. Well, yes, that is true, but there's this interesting concept when you're compiling software that you're actually building the software, so you're kind of a developer at this point. I mean, you're not. You didn't write anything, you're not doing anything really hard, other than compiling, which is hard to you and me, but you have to think like a developer. So the fact that you already have SDL installed on your system, yeah, that should, if you think about it from a user's perspective, that should mean that you have this magical SDL config thing. Well, the thing that you actually need, and if you do a yum list SDL, then you will see that you've, like I say, you've got SDL installed, but you've got, as an uninstalled option, you've got SDL-devel, D-E-V-E-L. Those are obviously the development files for SDL. And what are you? You're an acting developer. So in order to build an application, you may need packages marked as developer packages because you're actually building it. I mean, some packages are required for it to run once it's compiled into a binary. And that would be the package that you would list, you know, if you were going to package this up and send it to your friends. You might say, okay, you need to have SDL installed. I've built it for you, but in order to run it on your system, you need SDL. Well, in this case, it hasn't even been built yet, so you need SDL-DEVL. The moral of the story, the bottom line, is that if you're compiling software, grab the dependency and grab the development version, the development file, because I guarantee you, you will spend 4 hours running make repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly, banging your head against the desk, wondering why, you know, you've got SDL or you know, you name it, installed, and it won't. And, you know, those are all the dependencies. Why won't it install? I'm telling you that the reason is that you need a development version of that package as well. So install that. Okay, so before you type make in again, you want to do a make clean. Now, make clean will take everything, all the little files that it generated during the failed attempt at making, and it'll ditch them, it'll remove them, which is a good thing. You want a fresh start. So do a make clean. It'll clean up all the files that that it generated, and now you can try make again. So you type in make. Again, you'll get past all the wonderful SDL stuff, so you'll see cc-c, sdl-config, -c flags, -06, -w, -gggb, and all a whole bunch of stuff. And you'll see lots of this stuff, and you won't see any errors, and it'll be nice, it'll be good. Until you hit a certain point, maybe, let's say, and it requires, something called lex, L-E-X, lex megafile.l. And then it fails. It says make lex command not found. And sure enough, it gives you an error. Make asterisk 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 lex.yy.c error 127. Okay, so once again, we look at where the errors started, and that would be around the time that it hit lex, so lex megafile.l. That was right after it got finished all that SDL config stuff too. We got past one thing, we hit another roadblock. Oh well. So we need to install something called lex, L-E-X. Again, you do a yum search or an apt cache search, and just for the string L-E-X, and you'll get a whole bunch of different results, of course. And you might see, like, C-Lex and Flex and lots of different things. I have no idea what lex is, L-E-X. I couldn't tell you to save my life what that is. I couldn't tell you if lex was contained in Flex or C-Lex or some other application entirely. So again, you'd probably just want to do a Google search, possibly even on the error itself, like the make colon star 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 lex.yy.c error 127, and see what you get. Or just, you know, what contains lex, or, you know, whatever. And once you find out that, in fact, what you're looking for is something called Flex, F-L-E-X, then that is what you would install. That is good stuff. So then you would issue make clean again, and then you would do another make, and sure enough, it would actually finish without any errors. And once again, returning zero means it works. So if you don't hear any bad news, that means make has just worked, and you've just compiled your application. Now you have to install it. Thought you were finished, didn't you? Forgot about that last step. Well, first, before we install it, let's talk a little bit about CMake, or QMake, or GMake. These are other make applications. These are, it's typical that the three steps are .configure, make install. It's not always the case. Sometimes if it was written in for instance, it was written in C++ with Qt, a lot of times they'll use a program called CMake, which it's just a repository install away. You know, you just do a yum install cmake, or, you know, qmake, or whatever it's asking you for in the README file, and that is where you'd find this kind of information. Or if you just don't read README files and you do a .configure and then a make, a lot of times when the make fails, it will tell you you're not supposed to be running make on this. You need to run cmake. That I have seen sometimes, but even more typically, you're just going to look at the README file that came with the code that you downloaded, and it will say requirements. You know, it's going to require Ruby and Qt Ruby, GStreamer and Ruby bindings for GStreamer, and to install, in order to install foobar in /usr directory, run these commands: cmake space dcmake --install_prefix /usr. Sudo make install. That's pretty clear. So you don't do a .configure in this case. You just do cmake space -dcmake install prefix /usr, and then sudo make install. It's really simple. It's not a big deal. It'll only be a big deal if you've never heard of CMake or QMake or GMake or whatever other makes there are out there. If you see something in the README file about CMake, yes, that's a different application. Yes, you need to install it and use it instead of Make. If you see errors in your Make output about this program not requiring Make, then chances are it requires something else. But again, usually it will tell you what it requires, at least in my experience. Okay, now we can install it. Make install. This would, of course, fail, right? Because what did I just say? Make install. That should have been sudo make install, or su-c, quote, make install, end quote. So always run make install as root. Why? Because it's installing stuff into system directories. You know, you're being, like I said before, you're being the acting developer when you were making it. Well, now that you're installing it, you're the acting sysadmin, right? You have to put on your little admin hat. It might be a red hat, for instance. It could be a blue hat. It could be any color hat, but put it on. It's your administrator hat, then you, because you're going to be installing stuff into outside of your home directory, is what I'm trying to get at. So do an su space dash c space single quote make install in single quote, put in your password, and it will run all kinds of interesting little scripts or whatever it's doing, and install all the files that it knows it needs into all the proper locations. That usually goes pretty quickly, and I have very rarely seen errors at this point. If you've done a configure and a make, chances are the make install is going to work because there's not really anything left to do at that point. It's configured it, it's compiled it, all it wants to do now is put everything where it belongs. I guess in theory it could fail because certain directories that it thinks will exist do not exist. I have never encountered that, I do not think. Although, I'm trying to think if I ever did on OS X, because their directory structure is, you know, different just in little places here and there. But I'm pretty sure I've never run into such an issue. So, I don't think you're going to find very often that you have issues with a make install. That's just kind of, as long as you do it as root, it's just going to drop everything that you've already done and configured into the places that it needs to go to. But now you do have to run it. When you run it, ideally, it'll just be in your application menu. Like, you go to your KDE menu or your GNOME applications menu, and you'll just find the application with a nice little icon by it, waiting patiently to be launched. Sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't add itself to the menu. Not frequently, but might happen. So if you're not seeing it anywhere in your menu, one thing you might want to do is just try to run it from the terminal. So just type in, you know, foobar. Now if it says bash foobar command not found, that's not a good sign, right? Because it should have installed itself into your path. So where would we think this is? Well, you can just do a locate foobar, right? Just locate space foobar, and that'll search your system and try to find where foobar might be. And of course, you'll get a lot of results from the source code directory. So in my case, it might be /home/clat2/code/foobar-0.5 foobar_whatever. So yeah, you'd find a lot of the stuff just from the source code. You can ignore that. But eventually you'll see things more in your /usr directory, like maybe your /usr/local/bin/foobar_ng, let's say. And that would, of course, be why it didn't launch when you've typed in foobar. Turns out the name of the application itself, the actual executable binary, isn't foobar. This is kind of annoying when that happens. It's happened to me, I think, once, where, you know, you go to a site, sourceforge.net, you download foobar-0.5, you compile foobar, and the executable binary is called foobar_CLI, or something like that, or _NG, you know, some weird extension that they decide to give it. Usually there's a good reason for it. Specifically, the time it happened to me was because there was a few different versions of this application, depending on how you were going to use it. So it did make sense, and sure enough, the information was where it was in the README file, which of course I did not read, or I read it, but I didn't read it all the way down to the point where they were telling me exactly what was being installed, I guess. So it was really not their fault, but mine, which is quite often the case with errors of computer-related things. Yeah, if you read the README, it'll tell you frequently, these are the files that are going to be installed, and then you know the name of the binary executable. So you need to just launch foobar_ng rather than just typing in foobar. Know your executables, that's what I always say. There are some other ways to get around this as well. You should be able to find it, like if you launch Conker or Dolphin and go to applications : then it'll take you to your little, you know, meta application directory, and you should find a little shortcut to foobar_ng there. And again, I know this because in the README file it said foobar_ng.desktop, and that's usually like a little shortcut symlink thing to the executable. So you might be able to find it that way. Adding it to your applications menu. So if you did install, you know, foobar_ng and foobar_CLI, and neither of them got added to your applications menu, you should be able to add it yourself manually. I think in GNOME they'd call it a launcher, possibly. I don't really remember. But in KDE, you know, you just go to your menu editor, which you can accomplish quickly by just right-clicking on the K menu and going to menu editor. And you'll see a list of all the different, I guess, directories or the categories within your application or within your K menu. And you can choose, okay, let's say that foobar_ng, I think we said, was an audio application. So we'd put it in multimedia. And there's all my multimedia stuff. So I'll just do a new item. And then the name of it is the thing that I'll see. So I'll call it foobar. The description, I'll put GUI audio editor. Comment. I don't really know what the comment is. Okay, and then the command. The command is, of course, what we want it to run when we click on this menu item. And so we would want to give, I think we would want to give the full path of that application. So I'd do, you know, /usr/local/bin/foobar_ng. That will ensure that when I click on foobar in my menu, it launches it from there. If, on the other hand, if it was, let's say, a Python application, and we wanted to add it here, then we would say, okay, so this is foobar_ng, the description, Python audio editor using Qt framework, comment, whatever. Command would be Python space /usr/bin/local, or wherever it is, /foobar_ng.py. And I say that because you need to invoke the Python, you know, you can't just tell it to run the .py file. You need to tell Python to run the .py file. So that should work. So when should you not compile from source code? I mean, it seems to be working really nicely. Is there any reason not to compile from source code? Well, there is in the sense that you've got a package manager for managing things like this. So if you've got your package manager and is keeping track of everything that you've installed via the package manager, then when it checks with a big repository in the sky to see if anything's been updated that you haven't updated yet, if foobar releases their big 1.0 version and you've installed 0.5 from source code, your package manager is not going to know about that, and it's not going to be able to upgrade your foobar 0.5 to 1.0, so you're missing out on all the big fancy features unless you're just watching foobar on a daily basis and keeping track of their change logs and looking at their press releases and things like that, which you may or may not be doing. It just depends on what the application is, which, of course, is a perfect segue into why you should compile from source code. If you need an application really, really badly, and you can't find it on a trusted repository, then it may be that you want to install it from source code. It may be that it's not a bad application. It's not an application that's underdeveloped. It's just one that's niche enough that the user base of your distribution haven't packaged it yet. This was the case with a few things that I've got, just a couple of little networking gadgets that I've picked up, and they have specialized open source drivers or interfaces that you can download so that the thing works. But I don't know how many people, you know, have these specific gadgets, and apparently not enough that it would make it into any major. It's certainly not in the Debian repository, it's not in the Fedora repository, and it's not in Slack builds. So it's obviously not going to be found as a package anywhere, at least trusted. The decision to go out and just search the internet for an RPM, for instance, of this package, foobar, you know, .rpm, just find it somewhere, I'm not 100% comfortable with that. It depends. I mean, if you use, you know, gitdeb or whatever, or you know, find RPMs or something like that, you know, and you feel good about it and you feel fine about it, go for it. Me, I'm just not used to those. I don't use them that much. I use, you know, the official Fedora repository and RPM Fusion, which is the official unofficial Fedora repository, and those are the repositories that I use. And beyond those, I would rather just compile from source. So that's what I do. FFmpeg, for instance. I won't say that I just absolutely won't use a pre-compiled version of it, but it's a pain in the neck to use a pre-compiled package of it, because inevitably there are some codecs that they've left out, and the point of having FFmpeg, at least in a video and editing environment, is that you've got everything that you need so that you can transcode anything and everything so that you don't have to stop working. So yeah, it's just some things, you know, I have to compile it from source. Some things I don't want to have to think about compiling from source. Firefox, I would never want to compile that thing from source. I've tried it. It's too hard. Other things, like I say, yes, I want to. So it really just kind of depends on what you want to do, why you're going out and looking for this application. Is it because you're just eager to try something that looks kind of nifty? Or is it because it has some kind of function to it that would make your ability to switch over to Linux 100% possible? It might be worth compiling for that. You know, so it's not stable yet, so it hasn't been released as a package yet. Compile it, try it out, might work, might be great. Certainly that's been the case for me on a number of different software packages that I've needed. Couldn't find it as a package, compiled it, used it on a day-to-day basis without any problem. And once I learn how to package RPMs or do a Slack build, I will contribute to those sites. Now there are times, of course, that no matter how many times you read the documentation, no matter how many times you resolve the dependencies, no matter how many times you do internet searches, the compilation just doesn't work. It just fails consistently and persistently. Well, one of the reasons that you might be getting a whole bunch of compile errors is that the application might just require porting. It is true that Unix applications are quote-unquote portable, and they should be able to be taken from one system to another and compiled and run, but, you know, there are kind of levels to this whole portability theory. And depending on the application, you might find that really you do have to be more than just an acting developer. You've got to know what you're doing so that you can swap out system calls in the source code or something like that. And that's no joke. I mean, that's just, you know, I mean, something might have been written for FreeBSD, and you might think, well, you know, it's close enough to Linux. I'll just grab that source code and compile it, and it'll run. Not necessarily. If there's something very specific in it to FreeBSD that Linux simply doesn't have, you're going to find out that the compiling doesn't work. On one rare occasion, I found something that was written, it was actually called Pencil, the Lanimation program that I thought, I'll try this out. The Linux Outlaws had mentioned it on one of their shows. Unfortunately, it was written for OS X, and it was open source and everything, and it said it should theoretically work on Linux, but at the time he didn't have the developer didn't have any he hadn't ported it or anything, and there were some very specific, I guess, system calls in it, I'm guessing, that you just need to swap out in order to get it to compile properly on Linux. I'm not really sure, but there were some things that needed to be literally changed in the source code, and I made a stab at it. Couldn't figure it out, waited. Sure enough, someone from Ubuntu came around, ported it over to Ubuntu, and now there's a .deb file right there on the site. Good stuff, right? But that is something that you will run into. That was something that went back in the day when I was compiling, before I'd gone to Linux, I was compiling a lot of Unix stuff for OS X, and I kept running into programs that, you know, not surprisingly, were written more specifically for Linux, and just would not work compiling as is on OS X, and really did require portage. Another much less common reason for an application not to compile is that there's something wrong in the source code. You know, I mean, I have actually experienced that once, and it wasn't something that I determined, it was something that someone else determined, so I'm taking their word for it. But it was that the code just wasn't written correctly. It wasn't going to install at all. It wasn't going to compile because there was an error in it. Was it a bleeding edge release of the application? Yes. So it could be that it was, you know, so bleeding edge that it wasn't finished. It wasn't ready to compile yet. Maybe if I'd stepped back one release. I mean, I don't even think they were at the stage of releasing. They were still very much working on it. But you know, some kind of snapshot that was confirmed to work. Maybe that would have compiled. I don't know. The point is that there are some variables. Sometimes it's going to work. Sometimes it's not. I think that's pretty rare. I think that kind of thing is not going to happen very often. But I figure if you start compiling a lot, then you may run into that. So keep that in mind. That's a vague possibility, that it could just be that the code at this point is broken. Maybe step back a release or file a bug report and see if are you the only one not being able to compile this, or is the whole development team aware that it's not compiling right now and they're working on it. Of course, when you file a bug report, you need to go to the website and find out what they're using for bug reporting. Probably it's going to be Bugzilla, but sometimes it's just an email to the developer. Sometimes that's all they want. If it's a small project, they might not have gone out to the trouble of making an entire Bugzilla instance. Could just be that you email the lead developer, or the only developer in some cases, and tell him or her that, hey, I've got a Fedora system and it's not compiling. This is what I've tried. I always give them, you know, I do a uname-av on my system so that I get exactly what kernel I'm running. I get the GCC version, so you just do GCC space --version. That seems to be a really important one. And then I tell them what I'm trying. So it's .configure and make and su --c space single quote make install end single quote. And I tell them what error I am receiving. Sometimes I just copy and paste it in, whatever. Yet a third issue could be unresolvable dependencies. It could be that your application that you're trying to install is calling out for a dependency that you cannot obtain for some reason. Maybe it would conflict with something that you already have installed, another dependency that you have installed, or maybe it's a non-free software blob that you don't want to install, or maybe it's because it's not working because the dependency fails. And at that point, I think I'd give up. You could keep trying, but it just depends. At a certain point, when you're compiling and it's not working, you know, at a certain point, you're gonna have to give up. And one thing to do when you give up is look around and see if there's another application out there that will do the same thing as FooBar. Look around on SourceForge or Savannah or KDE-apps.org or Launchpad or you know, all these fresh meat, you know, all these sites with code on them. Look around, have a look, see if there's something else. If FooBar is an audio editor, try to find another open source audio editor that might do something similar. If FooBar is a video editor, look at the other options. If it's a really, really niche software to be the interface for some random gadget that you've gotten, it might be harder to find, but hopefully it'll be written well enough that it'll actually compile on your system without too much trouble. But sometimes you just gotta look elsewhere. Of course, that's kind of ending on a down note, so in my experience, here's the touching personal testimony. In my experience, compiling from software has been nothing but educational, fun, and satisfying. Really, actually. I'm serious. It is. It's very educational. You learn a lot when you compile from source code. You learn about all the different languages and all the different tools that developers use in order to make their programs work. You learn about you learn a lot about troubleshooting and, you know, how to get around weird errors and get around unexpected problems. You learn more about computers, how complex things are. I don't know, the more I compile, the less I complain about, you know, when my computer doesn't work, because I see just how complex they are and how many different possible variables there are. More often than not, I'm amazed when the computer does work rather than upset when it doesn't work. So, yeah, it's an educational thing. It's very satisfying because, you know, you sit there, you compile it, and then you start running it. And you went from a directory of text files to something with a GUI and that's helping you get work done, and you can sit back and you can really be proud of that. It's also, you know, there are arguments that it'll help optimize your system because you've compiled that software specifically set. You know, it's specifically configured for your exact configuration. I mean, that's what Gentoo is based on. So that's kind of cool. Yeah, and quite often it gives you applications that you can't really get otherwise. You know, that's my biggest reason for compiling. I'll find something on kde-apps.org or something, and I want it. And it's not packaged for Fedora. It's certainly not in Slack builds. So I compile it. It's a good reason to compile, and frequently it'll get you that cool little app before everyone else has it. So enjoy that. Have a good time with compiling, and best of luck. If you have any issues, you know, let me know. If I were you, I would sit right down at your computer when you get home, or if you're home already, sit down and grab a little application from somewhere and try to compile it just for kicks. You'll see how well you do. It's a bit of a challenge sometimes, but it, like I say, it's really satisfying, and it's a cool thing to do. So, enjoy. So at klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. Either of those will get to me. If you need to get to the website, that is thebadapples.info. My Jabber account is not klaatu@jabber.org. So if you are into the IM stuff, you can add me. I'm not on that often, but that's what it is anyway. IRC, of course, I'm on Freenode. Typically, I'm at least in Linux Cranks. I'm usually somewhere else as well, and my nick on there is not Klaatu. So all those many different ways to find me. You can certainly find me if you need anything. That's all the contact stuff, and I will see you next week.